Good evening, and welcome to the local news. Today is Monday, March 2nd, and I'm Nat Cardos, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, sit-in protest at Cal Poly Humboldt results in protesters leaving at 3 a.m., disputes over protester characterization, and the Wiat Tribe's Tulawet Project continues to work to restore Tulawet Island. So stay tuned. Those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkyon, Wailaki, Wiat, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
Last Friday, a sit-in was held on the quad of Cal Poly Humboldt, CPH, following a public forum with CPH Vice Presidents Mike Fisher, Chrissy Holliday, and Steve Karp, as well as other members of faculty. The public forum was held to discuss concerns surrounding immigration, labor negotiations, as well as the university's investments. The sit-in was eventually moved as the students began to occupy Nelson Hall East in the Goodwin Forum. According to a statement from protesters, demands included, quote, full divestment from war and genocide, foundation investments, end quote, arguing that CPH war-related investments being less than 1% is not zero and not enough. Other demands include a protective written sanctuary policy for the campus, specifically pointing out that in a prior statement from CPH President Richard Carvajal, which said, quote, our university commits to continuing our stance of not voluntarily sharing individual student data, end quote, and specifies that the university could share student data if immigration enforcement requests it. Additionally, they called for the university to accommodate employment requests for all staff, union and non-union. Reporter Ryan Hudson was on the scene and spoke with protesters who asked not to be identified at approximately 6 p.m. during the protest.
Yes, yeah, so about half an hour ago, there we received the university's written statement on, you know, what they're going to be doing to address our concerns. I'm going to do more
of that. We are still writing up a statement on that, and we will have to disclose information about that statement and what our deliberation is later once we get our statement in there.
Okay.
But there are ongoing negotiations. The Vice President, Michael Fisher, has been a lot more receptive to actually negotiating with us now that we've taken a real action and occupied this building.
Nelson Hall is home to the campus's cultural centers, which were closed due to the protest. Protesters made it clear that they were not going upstairs to them and also requested that administration open the cultural centers as well as the bathrooms, which were additionally locked. Protesters inside of the building eventually had to use buckets and water bottles when they had to urinate.
It's been hours. Admin has been made aware several times very early on that we have several people in there menstruating and they refuse to open the bathrooms. They just say, like, hey, if you want to use the bathroom, get out. They are weaponizing people's bodily functions in order to fight us, to stop us from fighting against genocide, from fighting against ICE, and for fighting for workers. We are a peaceful protest.
Yes.
We are far away from the cultural centers.
Yeah.
Admin, people into the fucking cultural centers.
So I'd like
they
to add to,
need yeah. those spaces.
I'd like to add to that. So there have been some statements going around that a lot of community members were like fearing for their safety and so left the building. We did. It was stated before the building was entered, when the building was entered, and once we reached this room, we are not going upstairs. We are not going to the cultural centers. That is not our goal. Our goal is occupying this room, and that's it. We're not doing anything else to Nelson Hall, right?
Okay.
The closing of the building, the shutting down of the bathrooms, that was all admin's doing. Anything that happened to the cultural centers was admin's doing. We are not here to like spread hate or division. We are here for our goals, and we regret the impact, but that's not our doing. It's admin.
They also locked up Nelson Hall before we even got in here. Before there was any even rumor that we were going in here, they locked this place up. So
including the cultural center.
Including the cultural centers, yeah.
Okay.
And again, we are peaceful. We are not violent. Like,
yeah. Okay.
And any escalation of violence will be on the university's side.
According to a statement from Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, minutes into the sit-in, administration had bathrooms locked throughout the building. At approximately 1 a.m., Arcata Police Department arrived through Library Circle and circled the building. According to a statement following the protest from the university, protesters left the building voluntarily later in the early hours of the morning. Quote, around 2 a.m., the individuals, protesters, left on their own, and the university was able to clear and secure the building. There were no arrests or injuries, end quote. SDS recounts a bit of a different story in their statement, which reads, quote, over loudspeakers, protesters were threatened with arrest and warned that failure could result in serious injury. Officers were visibly equipped with pepperball guns, and power to the building was cut. Protesters did not just leave on their own. They left after police surrounded the building and threatened them with violence. End quote. This is what protesters heard over loudspeakers from the Arcata Police Department.
If you do not do so, you may be arrested or subject to other police action. Other police actions could include the use of force, which may result in serious injury. Section 409 of the Penal Code prohibits remaining present.
Additionally, the statement from CPH President reads, quote, we have identified a number of individuals involved in the occupation, and the university is following established processes consistent with CSU and Cal Poly Humboldt policies to address the situation, end quote. Earlier today, KMUD spoke with Rick Toledo, a member of SDS who was present at the protests, and minutes before the interview, received word that he was being suspended for conduct charges. According to the email sent to Toledo, CPH alleges that he is in possible violation of Section 41301 of Title V of the California Code of Regulations, which outlines the standards for student conduct within the California State University CSU system. The email states, quote, it is alleged that you have assaulted a campus staff member to gain access to a building that had been closed by campus, that you allegedly also entered and exited into the building after being told it was closed for use in an unauthorized campus protest. End quote.
It just happened. Yeah, so I just got an email about 20 minutes ago, and it's like a conduct charges email with just a list of charges. It says that I am alleged to have assaulted a campus staff member to gain access to a building, which is crazy because I did not touch anybody. The closest I came to one of the staff members was putting my back to them and standing in front of them and waving through people who had food with them. So this is, and they've accused me of, geez, like all kinds of stuff. It seems like from what I'm reading here, they're using me as a fall guy because they don't know who the other people are yet because they were masked and I wasn't. But what's interesting is I wasn't one of the people sitting in to begin with. I just helped get food to people and supplies. And I was really on the outside. I didn't march in with them into Nelson Hall. I did, you know, pop in when they were writing the response to admin because they asked for my assistance with that. But by and large, this accuses me of being some sort of like a ringleader or something. And that's just not the case.
Toledo alleges that he wasn't a key person in the protest, but was part of it and supporting it.
So I was in the sit-in that happened the Friday before. And even to that, I brought protest signs because I was asked to. I brought a megaphone and I supported the protest. I helped them strengthen their demands and stuff. But at the end of the day, I wasn't even like a key organizer. You know, I've just been trying to support it. And I know SDS in general, we've been trying to use our platform to help support these demands and these students. And even with this one, I was there during the negotiations, quote unquote, that happened in the morning on Friday, but admin had turned it into what they called a listening session. And you know what that means, you know, it's y'all are going to listen to us talk at you. We're not actually going to negotiate anything. And that's really what it was. They were just trying to do like PR control. And at that, I was arguing with the admin. I was bringing up points and defending the demands. And then I joined them when the negotiations didn't go anywhere. I joined them in marching to the quad, sit-in in the quad, which I was a part of. And then I was asked to print out flyers to give to students to let them know that people were sitting in the quad. So I went to the library to print those. And then when I came back, they were in Nelson Hall. So that's like, I was definitely a part of a lot of what was happening and fully support it, but I wasn't like a key person.
Moving forward, he plans to fight the alleged conduct charges and suspension.
Oh, so I have a meeting with my lawyer tomorrow morning, so we will not be taking this sitting down. I will fight this, and I will be addressing the public, and I'm going to let people know what's going on. And I think, from what I understand, this is going to upset a lot of students and a lot of student activists, and I think that what they can expect are more escalations on campus now than they had before. So I think they're going to have their hands full, is what I'll say.
In the email, CPH also threatens further disciplinary action. Quote, please be advised that violation of the terms of this interim suspension may result in further disciplinary action up to and including permanent expulsion from Cal Poly Humboldt and the California State University system and or arrest for trespassing. End quote. KMUN News will continue to provide updates to the story as it develops. The Tolowat Project is an effort led by the Wiat tribe to restore Tolowat Island in Eureka, which was the site of a massacre on February 26, 1860, when settlers from the town rode to the island and murdered 80 to 250 Wiat people during their world renewal ceremony. Last week, on the massacre's 166th anniversary, KMUD went over the event and the history of the Wiat tribe working towards getting the island back, which occurred in 2019. On the anniversary, the city of Eureka also lowered flags at half-mast to honor the victims of the massacre, and we also spoke with Eureka Mayor Kim Burgell. This week, KMUN News spoke with Ted Hernandez, the Wiat Tribe's Public Works Director, as well as the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer, for more information about the fight to get the island back.
Actually, the fight to get the island back started the day after the massacre, when Gunther took over the island, and the tribe never gave up that island, and they always wanted, you know, the tribe always fought to get the island back. And then it really started with Albert James and his family going to the city of Eureka in the early 70s, saying that they would like to return the island back, and, you know, they kept meeting with the city, and the city kept telling them no, and, you know, then Cheryl Seidner and her council went and, you know, were able to get back the 40 acres on the north side back. And then at the time, I think it was Kim Burgell and Nellie Roy, and Kim was a little person, they came to the tribe and asked what they could do for the tribe, and we said to return the rest of the island, and that's where that whole process started for the rest of the return of the island.
In October of 2019, as previously mentioned in last week's story on Tolowat Island, 202 acres of the island were returned to the Wiat tribe. This event marked the first time a United States municipality voluntarily returned stolen land to a tribe without a sale, lawsuit, or court order. Hernandez recounts the ceremony and the weight of this gesture from the city.
That was an experience that I'll never forget. And the reason why I say that is because, you know, after the fights that my tribal elders had done over the years to get the island back, it started all with Albert James and his family in the early 70s. And then it went with Cheryl Seidner and her family, you know, in the early 2000s to get back the island. And then finally, you know, it ended with me in 2019 to get the final piece back. So, you know, I look at it as three different generations on the return and getting the island back. You know, you had the Albert James generation, you had the Cheryl Seidner generation, then you had my generation. It's amazing. I mean, it was just, it's hard to explain when you have all those people in that building, you know, just for the return of just that one, the last section of the island. It was something that I will never forget.
The Tulowat Project is part of the Natural Resources Department at the Wiat Tribe and collaborates with several groups, such as the Humboldt Harbor District, in acquiring funding for their work with the National Park Service Historic Preservation Fund, US EPA Brownfields Program, California Integrated Waste Management Board, the Center for Creative Land Recycling, and more. Currently, they are working with Caltrans District 1 to remove invasive Spartana grass on the island and replace it with native plants.
So, Tulowat Project is, we're online with RCAA and the Humboldt Harbor District to remove the, and also Caltrans is a part of this. We're online to remove the invasive Spartana grass that's on the island, which is not from here, but, you know, Humboldt Bay has the most of it in the California coast. So it's an invasive weed that we're trying to remove, and by us removing it and planting our traditional plants that were supposed to be on the island back so that they can come back to health. And, you know, we've done this project for so years ago, and it did work, and it does work, because we noticed in time that the traditional plants that were there on the island were actually sprouting up on their own. You know, we did do some planting, but we noticed as well that the natural plants that were supposed to be there were coming up on their own after we removed the Spartana.
Another facet of the work the Tulowat Project does is preservation of the clamshell mound on the island. The clamshell mound measures over 6 acres in size and is estimated to be over 1,000 years old. Within the mound are remnants of meals, tools, and ceremonies, as well as many burial sites, and after the island was diked at the end of the 19th century, the changing tides began to accelerate erosion. Other factors of this erosion include climate change, and the project and tribe continue to work on preventative measures to mitigate the erosion.
The clamshell mound is pretty much, you know, when we would go out and harvest, we would, you know, crush our shells and put them on the island, and we would never waste nothing as a WEOP member. And that's why you see the clamshell mound is because that's where usually our kitchens were, our houses were, or what we ate. And it built up the island so much, you know, that's why you hardly see, like, where the rookery is and where the, on the north side, it's using that underwater skill of our clamshell mound. So we pretty much built our island to go up and, you know, and it protects us from the high tides and the king tides. It was, on the north side, there is some erosion, but I think we put a little stop to that with the work that's been done in the past. And of course, you're going to have some erosion because of climate change. But as a tribe, we are looking on how to stop that from happening and continue happening, you know, and prevent it from happening. But you're still going to get it no matter which way you look at it because of climate change.
Over the years, the Wiat tribe, through the Tolowut Project, have been able to remove over 60 tons of scrap metal and several tons of garbage from the island, as well as create some erosion control through installing 450 feet of composite sheet piling, backpiled with 300 cubic yards of imported fill, as well as native plant landscaping over portions of the island.
So I think the most important part that people shouldn't realize is that, you know, we as a Wiat tribe and the Wiat people, we are, you know, our main priority is making sure that our lands are restored to what they should be, what Creator put us here for. And that way, you know, once we have restoration back and balance back, we can probably bring balance back into the world and help restore the world to where it needs to be as well. But we have to start with our island first because that's our home. That's our, you know, the ceremonial spot for our prayers, our high dance. And we need to bring that back to health first and heal it so that we can bring the real balance back to the world, you know, with all our sister tribes, by all of us doing our high dances together so we can bring the balance back.
For more information on the Tolowut Project, the website is wiat.us/186/Tolowut-project. In national news, updates on the conflict in Iran from KPFA's Lauren Schmidt.
U.S.-Israeli strikes on Iran continued for a second day following the reported killing of the Iranian supreme leader. Iran has retaliated by launching strikes across 8 countries in the region, and as a result, 3 U.S. service members have been killed. Donald Trump acknowledged the casualties in a virtual address this afternoon.
As one nation, we grieve for the true American patriots who have made the ultimate sacrifice for our nation, even as we continue the righteous mission for which they gave their lives. We pray for the full recovery of the wounded and send our immense love and eternal gratitude to the families of the fallen. And sadly, there will likely be more. Before it ends, that's the way it is.
At an emergency session of the United Nations Security Council Saturday, U.S. Representative Mike Walls praised the president's actions.
This is a moment in history that requires moral clarity, and President Trump has met the moment.
In Iran, over 200 people were killed inside the country. Half of the casualties were from a strike on an all-girls school, killing students and teachers. The Council on American Islamic Relations Deputy Director Edward Ahmad Mitchell condemned the killing.
It's beyond irony that in the first hours of this war, either the Israeli government or the United States working with Israel killed dozens of Iranian schoolgirls while supposedly trying to liberate the people and women of Iran.
The U.S. military says it is reviewing the report. In Israel, at least 9 people have been killed in a missile strike on the town of Beit Shemesh. Other deaths have been reported in the UAE, Kuwait, and Iraq. Injuries have also been sustained in Bahrain and Qatar during retaliatory attacks. Missile defense systems largely prevented additional casualties in the Gulf nations. And most of the damage is inside Iran, where Israel says its air force dropped more than 1,200 munitions across 24 of Iran's 31 provinces. The U.S. military claims it has struck more than 1,000 targets inside Iran since the operation began. Donald Trump posted on social media that 9 Iranian naval vessels have been destroyed. The Associated Press is referring to the escalating attacks and counterattacks as a war, citing the scope and intensity of the fighting. Speaking to reporters from his office in Greenville, South Carolina, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham commented on what victory looks like in this war.
Victory looks like a bloodthirsty Ayatollah who is no longer in charge, no longer has the capability to build missiles to hit America, no longer has the capability to build a nuclear weapon.
Graham's statements on nuclear capabilities contradict U.S. intelligence. Despite the reported killing of Ali Khamenei, Donald Trump told Britain's Daily Mail that the conflict would last around 4 weeks. Trump updated on his end goal during his Sunday address.
Combat operations continue at this time in full force, and they will continue until all of our objectives are achieved. We have very strong objectives.
However, the full scope of the war and the administration's long-term objectives remain unclear. CARES' Ahmed Mitchell is encouraging all Americans to contact the White House and their members of Congress to demand what they call the Trump administration's, quote, unnecessary, unjustified, and unconstitutional war, close quote.
Well, this was an illegal war. It's just as illegal as the Iraq War was in 2003. And it's time for Congress to do its job, to exercise its authority over the declaration of war and stop this war before more innocent people and before more American soldiers die.
California Democrat Ro Khanna is urging Congress to convene Monday.
To vote on Thomas Massie and my war powers resolution to stop this war. Trump says his goal is to topple the Iranian regime. But the American people are tired of regime change wars that cost us billions of dollars and risk our lives. We don't want to be at war with a country of 90 million people in the Middle East. Every member of Congress must go on record today on how they will vote on Thomas Massie and my war powers resolution.
Iran has now formed a 3-member leadership council to govern until a new supreme leader is selected. And according to reporting by the Associated Press, the new leadership of Iran suggested that they are open to talks with the United States. And Donald Trump is, quote, eventually willing. Protests have erupted across the United States and in several countries abroad. In San Francisco, the Iranian American community of Northern California is protesting in Union Square in support of a democratic transition in Iran. Hamid Azimi.
The change in Iran must happen organically from within Iran.
In Pakistan, authorities say at least 22 people were killed and more than 120 wounded in clashes after protesters stormed the U.S. consulate. For KPFA News Headlines, I'm Lauren Schmidt.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A state task force in Alaska has released recommendations for making psychedelic therapy available if treatments are approved at the federal level. Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra has the story.
The Alaska State Legislature established the task force in 2024 to examine psychedelic therapies, which hold a lot of promise but are still considered experimental. Jenny Armstrong is a former state representative who was on the task force. She says the group tackled questions like how to make therapy accessible and how to offer safe and culturally competent care.
And the whole point of the task force was to bring up these types of questions so we're not scratching our head when this becomes medicalized and scrambling and being reactive, but we're actually being proactive.
The task force did not take a stance on whether psychedelic therapies are good or bad, but recommends Alaska incorporate them as they are legalized nationally. None of the task force's recommendations are binding, but Armstrong says they're meant to guide legislators on the type of laws the state would need to offer access. Armstrong says the task force recommends incorporating a training program for therapists and healthcare providers who want to guide therapy.
Everyone needs to go through this type of training because just being a doctor doesn't make you qualified to facilitate this type of care.
And she says the aim is to make training accessible so a diversity of people can become certified. She says that would ensure people getting treated are a good fit with the person who guides them. Armstrong says Alaskans could benefit a lot from psychedelic therapies if they're legalized. That's because the state has such high rates of post-traumatic stress disorder, substance use disorders, and other mental illnesses. Psychedelic therapies are being studied to treat those disorders, and Armstrong says some of the research is promising.
There are so many folks who, through these trials, went from being suicidal and having treatment-resistant depression, unable to work, unable to function, to being in remission within months.
She says that can change how people and communities can thrive. For National Native News, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
There's a new career pathway for tribal students looking at wildland firefighting jobs. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has more on the partnership between the Bureau of Indian Education and the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
High schoolers across six BIE-run schools are participating, including Northwest High School in Shiprock on the Navajo Nation.
This just happened to occur organically.
Carmelia Bacenti is Dene and Chief Academic Officer for the Bureau of Indian Education. She credits President Trump's executive order on expanding educational freedom. They're also pitching the curriculum to colleges.
We are trying to somewhat steer them towards being stewards of our lands. That doesn't always happen.
Gar Fisher's with the BIA Division of Wildland Fire Management. He says they're teaching coursework about leadership, fire suppression, and FEMA readiness. Once done, students put their training to the test during a field day.
They get to put the gear on, how it feels, they get to look like a firefighter.
That equipment is expensive, says Bacenti, which is why the BIE is buying it now.
And that way, year after year, as we recruit more students at these schools and across the Bureau, you know, we have this PPE that we can use over and over and over.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Javier Rodriguez, and thanks to our reporters, Lauren Schmidt and Antonia Gonzalez. KMA News is online, and you can find us on KMA.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Matt Cardos.